From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, a former Wall Street Journal correspondent works to improve nutrition and reduce hunger around the world. Plus, Milwaukee Magazine looks at two fashion stories that are about much more than style. And then, two classic tales reimagined. First, the Milwaukee Ballet's spin on Snow White.
We're always thinking about the evil stepmother and then Snow White. And I thought, let's try and investigate some way of this being a little bit more interesting.
And the producers of an offbeat adaptation of Hamlet that turns it into a time-traveling comedy.
We wanted to make people laugh, but really no one's seen the film up until that screening, so we just had our fingers crossed that it was actually funny.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in. Around 5 years ago, Roger Thoreau was a correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, working on a book with a colleague about global hunger when he hit upon a mantra that would spark a shift in his career. As the book came out and his Outrage and Inspire effort was born, Thoreau left his position in Africa and at the newspaper where he'd worked for 3 decades and signed on at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs as Senior Fellow on Global Agriculture and Food Policy. It's in that role that he continues to work on hunger issues around the world, including here in the United States. His work more recently has grown to include another project on the importance of early nutrition called the 1,000 Days Project. He was in Milwaukee recently to talk about that work and stop by the Lake Effect studio, along with Magda Peck, the dean of the UWM School of Public Health. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
So you have this Outrage and Inspire project underway, and there are a lot of people out there who have dedicated time and resources to doing something about hunger around the world, but I gather one area in which you feel like you can especially contribute is in your ability to tell stories.
Yes, and thank you. I think that's a critical aspect of this, that as we look kind of back at books that had been written on this issue, a lot of them were kind of academic books, so they were like development textbooks, you know, for classroom studies. Or they were written by economists, and they're looking at things from 40,000 feet down. Or they were like polemics or screeds by somebody who's got an angle that they're really driving.
Trying to shame us into change.
Yeah, precisely. Or, you know, promoting some other aspect of that, you know, this is really great or something. And we just figured that just the storytelling of particularly the people on the ground in the developing world, and in my case especially in Africa, and when we're seeing all this come into play and the impact, say, of American policies, unintended in you know, consequences of, say, our farm bill or the way we did our food aid, the global trade of agriculture, really saw that come into play during the Ethiopian famine of 2003. And I wrote a lot about that for the Wall Street Journal. And that I think that impact and being able to tell those stories of here's these consequences and here's the people that are suffering by having brought hunger into the 21st century, and shame on us for doing that.
Well, and so where does the 1,000 Days Project fit into this dynamic?
Yeah, so it's kind of the progression of the reporting that I was doing. And say after the Ethiopian famine of 2003, or kind of in the midst of that, you know, I'd been, as I said, a foreign correspondent for the journal for close to 2 decades by that time, and doing and behaving as foreign correspondents do. You travel from country to country and place to place and story to story, and then, boom, you move on and you go to some other place. That story, the famine of Ethiopia in 2003, it was the first great famine, the first great hunger crisis of the 21st century, really stopped me cold. It was what was then inspiring my journalism, that this is one story that I cannot leave. I have to keep coming back to this story. So that was kind of, you know, one talks about kind of, you know, positive disruption or things, you know, both in, you know, technology or whatever. This in my life as a journalist, or my career as a journalist in my life, really changed things, that this is the one story I want to write about. So I wrote that first book with Scott on Enough, Why the World's Poor Suffer in an Age of Plenty. And then the second book I did, wanting to follow on that, was to really look at the smallholder farmers, again, particularly in Africa, who were kind of bearing the brunt of this neglect.
Explain the significance of smallholder farmers. I don't know that that's a term that everybody knows what it means.
Right. So smallholder farmers, different than, say, the concept here. Smallholder farmers, say, in an African context would be like maybe 3 acres that they would have, maybe kind of at the most, half acre, 1 acre, 2 acres. And it's on that small plot of land that they have to feed their families. And then hopefully have a surplus or something that they're able to sell for, you know, to improve their house, to diversify their farm, to pay for the kids' school education, to pay for the malaria medication, health issues. It's these smallholder farmers then, kind of because this neglect of agriculture development, you know, that kind of all the big development agencies in the world were kind of part of, including USAID and the British DFID, these farmers were kind of ignored, and people kind of said, you know, they're too poor, too remote, too small, too insignificant. Who kind of cares about them? They're not possible clients or customers, or what kind of market are they? So the result of all that is that they were far behind farmers everywhere else in the world in terms of yields. Say in comparison to American farmers, maybe their yields of corn or maize would be maybe 1/10 of what the farmers here would get on, say, per acre. Wheat, beans, you know, anything, the vegetables that they're growing, all really lagging behind. And the upshot of that was, which I think is perhaps the cruelest irony of Africa, is that Africa's hungriest people are her smallholder farmers. And it creates this bizarre and stupid and obscene oxymoron of hungry farmers.
And presumably this plays into the 1,000 Days
right.
project, because these hungry farmers are raising hungry children.
Exactly. And so it was kind of the progression then of the coverage of the Wall Street Journal in the first two books I did that then led me into the 1,000 Days. And particularly looking at the importance of nutrition in those 1,000 days, so during a woman's pregnancy and the vital the necessity of the minerals and nutrients that the mom needs, and then in the first 2 years of a child's life, when the brain is growing, you know, most rapidly, and it's when stunting begins, the physical and mental stunting of a child begins at that stage. But a couple of the farm families that I was following then in the last hunger season, there were four farm families in western Kenya. A couple of the children in those families were manifestly malnourished. And there I saw that in this time of the hunger season, which is the period between when the food from the previous harvest runs out, is either consumed by the family or sold for whatever purposes for the income, and when the next harvest comes in. And that can be a period of, say, a couple of weeks, or in one of the farm families in the story, it stretched on for 9 or 10 months. So it's this period of profound deprivation, when the number of where food is rationed, the number of meals decline from 3 a day to 2 to 1, to some days basically nothing except maybe a weak cup of porridge in the morning or a cup of tea, you know, without sugar, and just kind of water with a little bit of tea flavor in it. And there, kind of in the midst of that, to see the deepest form of that misery, to be a mother who is raising a malnourished child, or to be a mother who cannot stop the crying of a malnourished and hungry child. And that then was then the beginning, while I was still reporting that book and finishing the writing of that, then thinking of what's next. And the 1,000 Days movement was starting to form, the whole scaling up nutrition, international development starting to focus on this period and the impact for economies of countries, for the health of the world, for the individual health, that I figured, yeah, this would be something that I'd really concentrate on. And so for the 1,000 Days, I'm following women starting at some stage in their pregnancy and then following through to second birthday to child in Uganda, India, Guatemala, and then in the U.S., and I'm following some families in Chicago.
And that really struck me, that we think of nutrition, sadly, in the developing world as being a significant issue, but it is an issue in this country as well.
Absolutely. And that's why I wanted to include the United States, that it's just not a problem that's over there somewhere in those countries, but it's also a vital issue here. And then in Chicago, I was living in Chicago at the time when started this project, and so that was convenient. But also the issue that Chicago was dealing with in the research going on in terms of food deserts. The mayor at the time was, you know, closing schools in Chicago. You know, maybe one of the reasons for failed schools is because the children in that crucial time of development, maybe they're not getting the proper nutrition, so they're not even prepared to go to school in kindergarten and first grade when they start. And so, kind of setting up this path of failure.
As you look at this problem and look towards solutions, how much of what is needed do you think is technology? How much is money, and how much is willpower?
willpower is a critical thing that people recognize this problem and say we've got to do something about it. And I think particularly as they would look at their comparative statistics of where Chicago or Milwaukee sits or Wisconsin or Illinois kind of sit on a national scale on these things, you would think that kind of the political leaders would say, my goodness, look where we're standing here. We can't have that. We have to be improved, particularly in this area where we're in the Midwest with the most fertile soils in the world. We're the breadbasket of the world, and we have these problems here. You know, kind of what's going on. But the other thing is, in terms of investments, I think it really shows that investments in women and investments in children are really important and need to be prioritized, and also starting at this early stage, whether it's kind of early childhood education, nutrition information and education, the prenatal care. And the education information, it's just very simple and basic about the nutrients that are important, the importance of a diversified diet. And the interesting thing in my reporting is that is something that I'm hearing, whether it is being a midwife in Africa talking to a group of pregnant moms or moms with newborn infants who are sitting under a tree in Africa, or it's the instruction that's going on a veranda in a house in India, or in a little community center somewhere in Guatemala, or in a living room or a kitchen here in the United States. It's the same message and the same kind of basic education that goes on, the nutrition, and then also the sanitation, so the proper, you know, hand washing and sanitary environment where the moms are living and the kids are growing up, because that's really important for kind of the parasite load and just the cleanliness of things.
I want to bring Magda Peck in this conversation as well for this final question, and that is, who has to drive this change? And if you're listening to this in Milwaukee, you know, what's the role that someone in the community here plays in this whole equation?
Well, the first is to recognize there's no one thing we can do, so we can't just easily fix it. And one of the things I find about being in Milwaukee and in other cities is that we like the simple solution, and this does not have a simple solution, but it's not unsolvable. I think part of what's happening in Milwaukee is we tend to think about, well, we'll feed people. We'll give an extra box of Cheerios. We'll fill it up with surplus cans that I wasn't used for the last 6 months. That's not going to fix the problem. I think the big deal about doing something about it is to reframe it and recognize that it has a sense of urgency. So I love the 1,000 days approach because it says that we get to talk about what we're doing in infant mortality, what we're doing in early childhood education, and what we're doing about food deserts and food security all together. Right now, those conversations are happening in lots of different places. So first, I would say recognize that it is happening here. It's happening here with urgency, perhaps a quieter one. Recognize there isn't a single thing to do, and yes, bring that can to church, but know that that's not going to fix it, that it really is about understanding how food systems work and how we can work across our different initiatives in town so that when we're talking about infant mortality, we're talking about healthy nutrition, we're talking about early childhood education and school success, we're not just going to different meetings and not connecting the dots.
I think one of the key things there is the empowerment of women and moms, that they have a lot to say about this themselves. Empowerment of communities and neighborhoods around this, that, you know, we don't have – and when one sees this in some places like in India, you know, communities that I'm looking at are kind of gathering around the whole aspect of reducing infant mortality. Why are so many of our children dying under five or within the first month of life or something? You know, what can we do about that as mothers? But I think then kind of as a greater community as a whole for the political will, you said, and the politicians. But I think it's also so critical that, say, the business community gets involved in this because the impact falls directly on them eventually. This all catches up when you have the, say, undernourished or a slow development or undernourishment of a child and then the cognitive development that may lag because of that. That all comes through the school system and it ends up certainly in the workforce. And as the workforce becomes increasingly skilled and the tasks and jobs that are required, increasing education needed, increasing skills, this workforce is an educated and a skilled and a really cognitive developed workforce is really important.
there are so many assets to build on in Milwaukee. This is not a starting place, but this is a growing place. A real shout out needs to go not only to Growing Power and the Hunger Task Force and Fondy Food Market and Walnut Way and the Food Council. There is a movement happening in this city that is recognizing that it's not enough just to hand people a meal, but it goes back to growing food, supplying food. Healthy choice becomes the easy choice. And that's conversations that are happening in folks' kitchens, in local gardening plots, in Alice's garden. And it's something that is bubbling up. So this notion of local empowerment is there. What's needed is to have a shared vision and the fact that we need to be doing more now and it can be done. So inspire, yes, but a little outrage could go a long way. We have our own hunger season. Our hunger period here is the period when the food stamps run out and the next check doesn't come yet.
Yeah,
when it's when the refrigerator is going on empty. We have our own hunger season from when kids go home from a food program where they're able to get reduced school lunches and be fed breakfast. And they're stuffing their pockets to be able to then have enough food in their backpacks on the weekend, or we send them home with food. That's the quiet hunger season, is the weekends or the summer when school's out. We should say, that is not on our watch.
Magda Peck, Roger Thurow, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Roger Thurow is Senior Fellow on Global Agriculture and Food Policy at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, creator of the Outrage and Inspire Project, and author of two books, including Enough, Why the World's Poorest Starve in an Age of Plenty. He grew up just down the road in Crystal Lake, Illinois. Magda Peck is Dean of the Zilber School of Public Health at UW-Milwaukee. Two stories that connect the fashion world to bigger issues when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Milwaukee Magazine often features articles on fashion and style. This month, though, two articles by writer Claire Hannon illustrate the intersection of fashion and broader cultural issues. Hannon joins us now to go into a little more detail about each of the stories. Nice to see you again. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me back.
We're going to talk about a couple of things under the mantle of style today. And so let's start with a write-up you did on a woman named Lynn Waite, who owns a shop in Shorewood. And, you know, that would be, you know, reasonably good enough for her. But what's the real significance of what Lynn Waite is doing?
So Lynn has kind of traveled all over, and our dining critic actually recommended her to me because she was like, she has some really cool stuff in her store. Check it out. So I checked it out, and it turns out Lynn designs a lot of the things that she sells in her store, which are like using all natural and organic fabrics, and they're kind of like earthy, sort of southwesty pieces that she creates. But anyway, so she had kind of been doing individual pieces, one-offs, for a few years, and she recently decided to ramp up production. At the same time, she met these people who had kind of fallen on hard times and needed a little extra money. So she said, well, if you can sew, why don't you sew these clothes for me and help me produce them? So she hired five local people who are all great sewers, and she pays them between 10 and 18 bucks an hour to create these pieces.
And so, this has allowed her to scale up, if you will.
Yeah, yeah. It's great for her. She has way more inventory, and she hopes to get even bigger and to add even more people helping, like, physically make the clothes.
And her stuff is getting noticed?
Well, I certainly noticed it. I mean,
you described it as earthy. I mean, this is
Yeah, well, it's a lot of like linens and some pretty simple designs, but they're pieces. In the magazine, we have this really fantastic like kind of deep blue coat that she's wearing, and you can belt it or wear it open, kind of like a robe. But it's kind of multi-season, practical, super sturdy, just kind of everyday wear. And it's the simplicity that's nice. You can dress it up with like a pretty scarf. But I just thought she has a good eye for designs, and it's pretty cool that she's employing these local people to put it all together.
And what is her store again?
It's Min's in Shorewood.
So you wrote another piece in the current issue of Milwaukee Magazine about an exhibit that is opening this week at the Milwaukee Public Museum. It's called Beyond the Veil. And one of the interesting points you make in your piece is that Beyond the Veil seems to be at least somewhat emblematic of a broader trend with museums doing exhibits on clothes.
Yeah. And I talked to Mount Mary's, their director of their historic costume archives, which is in itself a huge museum quality trove of historic clothing. And she goes to all these exhibits, and she says that they're kind of popping up everywhere because – and this is so simple. It, like, hits you over the head with simplicity because clothing is more relatable than a painting. You know, everyone has to wear clothing. Not everyone has to buy sculptures or paintings. Or has the luxury to do that.
You also make the point that that women's clothing has been a particular flashpoint.
Well, yeah, it certainly is for a whole host of reasons. Just the most obvious being the variation in women's clothing is, you know, 100 times more complex than men's. But it has to do with gender and, you know, a morphing, ever-morphing society and fascination with women's bodies and its culture, and it's all can be balled up into clothing sometimes, which is why this exhibit is so fascinating because it talks about a very particular type of clothing, which is Middle Eastern clothing, and it's broken down regionally because they're vastly different, and just how especially in the U.S., in Wisconsin, and in Milwaukee, there are certain conceptions some people have with Middle Eastern clothing, and there are some snap judgments made.
Frankly, a lot of people just think Middle Eastern clothing for women is just about the veil.
Yes. And as the title suggests, this goes way beyond that and talks about the dresses. A lot of them are called thobes. And just how that these clothes are so much more important culturally and can't really be boiled down to I'm wearing this for a religious reason only, or I'm wearing this, you know, to defy the patriarchy. It's so much more complex than that. And this is a small exhibit that gets into some really huge issues.
Right. And in your article, you make the point that for the concept that many Westerners have about the idea of Muslim women going out with a veil and you know, things on their head, for all of that discussion, it really hasn't been so long since people in British and American culture, women would always go out wearing a hat as well.
Right. Yeah. It's very easy to forget how much head coverings have played a part in our long history of clothing, not only for religious reasons, but those were a huge part of them. And in a lot of religions, men wore head coverings too. When there was kind of recent backlash in the last 10 years or so against veils again, a lot of people were saying they're oppressive and, you know, this is signs of being submissive to a patriarchal society that's no longer there. And on. It's just so much more complex than that. And people wear them, Muslim women in Milwaukee wear them for so many different reasons, in addition to all these other sort of cultural clothing pieces.
Well, and we should also make the point that another thing that makes this exhibit remarkable is that it is a homegrown exhibit.
Yes. This was organized by this group that is a resource and research center, and they just studied a ton of Middle Eastern women in the Milwaukee area and basically just surveyed them, asking them, why did you come here? You know, what did you bring with you? And also, tell me about the clothes. Why do you wear them? How have you altered them? So some of those results make up sort of the credit info that's along with the exhibit. In addition to, a lot of these women donated their own thobes and jewelry and kind of large tunics.
Interesting couple of pieces. Claire Hannon, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Claire Hannon is associate editor at Milwaukee Magazine. Her articles on the Beyond the Veil exhibit and designer and boutique owner Lynn Waite are in the May issue of the magazine. Two classic stories redone in some really interesting ways, the first of them by the Milwaukee Ballet. We'll get the story of Mirror, Mirror when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. more of Lake Effect Now, I'm Mitch Teich. Since Michael Pink came to Milwaukee Ballet more than a decade ago, he's made his mark with his powerful efforts to produce story ballets, works with a narrative storyline, including Peter Pan, La Boheme, and even Dracula. His latest, and the ballet's latest, is no exception. It's the world premiere of Mirror Mirror, a retelling and reimagining of the classic fairy tale Snow White. Lake Effect's Bonnie North met Pink at the ballet on a rehearsal break, and he said the production has long been in the works.
This one has been around a long time. 1999 was the first draft that I did in our little hamlet in Yorkshire, and I was writing down this story, and I thought, you know, interesting how to delve into this story of Snow White. We're always thinking about the evil stepmother and then Snow White, and I thought, let's try and investigate some way of this being a little bit more interesting. And I wanted also to explore why, where did the mirror come from, and why is the evil stepmother supposed to be evil? So the usual story, the usual questions that we ask ourselves. So I started work on that. It originally had lots of projection in it, lots of technology, lots of exciting things. And then over the years, instead of adding to that side of it, I withdrew. I started going backwards into, you know, let me take away technology. Let me just really get behind the story and use visual stimulus for me more than anything else. So 2005, I think I revisited it, and the synopsis that we have now has been evolving since that time. Philip Feeney, the composer from Dracula, Peter Pan, Esmeralda, I asked Philip to work with me again purely because it's a comfort factor for me. I can rely on Philip to be there to provide the world we need and to challenge the musicians and everybody. And so Philip has created a score that is actually quite different, because most of our previous work has been rooted in some sort of reality, whether it's been Dracula, and we've tried to create a realistic feel and look to that. This is very much more surreal in some respects. I wanted a production that would have fantasy costumes. Todd Ivins, who's a designer I've met when I worked on Cabaret at the Repertory Theatre, Todd has, and I have become good friends, good working colleagues, and I asked him to foray into the world of dance, and he's done a brilliant job of creating a surreal world in which we can tell this very interesting story. David Grill, our lighting designer, who has now become a part of this organization, thank goodness. David is, of course, the man that does Super Bowl halftime. He does all of the major games. His real passion and love is with dance and theater. He creates the story with light. So people have always been, have noted the incredible detail within the lighting and how exciting it is. So that, again, becomes answers to something we've talked a lot about, which is that it takes a team. It takes a huge team to create anything at the ballet. And so there we have a fabulous team of creative artists. And then, of course, the costumes, the scenery, all of this has been made by Milwaukee Ballet. So the artisans that work at Milwaukee Ballet, Mary Peering, who runs our costume shop, has been working on this for 18 months. And an incredible team of people building these elaborate costumes. They're not run-of-the-mill things. They're not things you buy off the peg or you'd see. They needed to be created and stylized. The scenery, which is in some ways is minimalist, but strangely enough, when it all comes together, it looks rather complex. That's all been built by our fabulous workshop, which is here in town, local craftsmen, local technicians that work with us here. So again, I'm delighted that we have been able to source this here in Milwaukee, and this is truly something that represents the depth of talent that we have here in this community.
So born in Yorkshire, but really come to fruition here.
Absolutely, yes, absolutely. And I think I never put a time frame on any of the synopsis that I've written over my career. It just sits there on a shelf gathering dust until it falls off or the shelf collapses or something draws me back to it. And yeah, this felt like the right time to do this. And I think the confidence that the ballet has built over the last 10 years in terms of producing excellence on stage and quality for money. I mean, I hate to keep talking about money, but I want to be able to say to people in a very proud and accomplished way that we're spending very, very few dollars on producing these productions, but the quality is $1 million. So I'm thrilled that really we found an opportunity to make a production like Mirror Mirror work on the stage, and it is working. It's quite spectacular. There are many, many things about the production that I think are interesting. The backstory, we call the backstory, is the mirror. where did the mirror come from? So I created a backstory where there is an idyllic community that's built around an apple orchard. So it represents growth and life and the seasons. And
an Eden, almost.
Eden, yes. Thank you. Good. Well done, Bonnie. Can always rely on you.
Thank you.
So, yeah, there's real depth to this story. And Beatrice, who's this beautiful young woman with her husband, Josef, she sat under a tree, and lo and behold, this falling star falls from the heavens into her lap. And when she looks into the fallen star, she can not only see her own reflection, but she can see into the future. And she lifts it up and she asks, when will she be with child? And the mirror tells her, before the next harvest, she'll be with child. And we see this passage of time in which she has her baby, and then the passage of time becomes a young Snow White. And then we introduce the stepmother-to-be, who covets the mirror. She's heard. Everybody's heard about this magic mirror, and who wouldn't want a mirror that could tell the future and would tell you you're the fairest of them all? And so that, for me, gives the whole production this backstory that I think is so powerful, because now we know what the game is. We know what the objective of Claudia, who is the stepmother. She wants this mirror. And as in all good Shakespearean dramas, we've got to have all this intrigue. And so Claudia comes to town. She seduces the bereaved husband. Snow White, of course, the rest of the story is the same. She's not happy with this arrangement. And we watch Claudia slowly manipulate every person in the community who will be one step closer to her, not only gaining the mirror, but also becoming the almighty and the powerful. She'll take over, and she'll use everybody. So she'll seduce the father of the prince, as he would be referred to. She will seduce him and make him the assassin. So you have this wonderful intrigue plot. As with all my work, it can be as complex on paper as we like, but it has to work visually without words in the theater. Is it appropriate for children? As soon as you mention something that's slightly dark, it always, always, always amuses me that people suddenly think we have to protect all of our children from this. And I'm going, just a minute. Let's look at the many versions. Let's look at that first Disney version of it. It's pretty dark and it's pretty frightening. And you know what? I mean, I have kids with healthy imaginations. They would beat me about the head if I didn't give them that level of dark intrigue and excitement that kids just thrive on.
Well, all fairy tales start out that way. My goodness, none of them are light and fluffy. They're morality tales, and they are allegories, and they're all kinds of things to kind of teach kids what the world is like.
And that's exactly it. And as we know, I mean, before they were sanitized and made fairy tales, they were folk tales, and all of those folk tales had birds pecking eyes out and feet being chopped off and babies drowned in rivers. It was always about, as you say, all the morality. And I think this production will give you lots of that. And I think children are blessed with seeing things through the lens of their eyes. So we mustn't superimpose our prejudices, our fears, our knowledge on our children, especially in nonverbal theater. They're not going to hear offensive language. They're not going to be contaminated by the aggressive use of language. They're just going to sit and watch nonverbal theater with spectacular music, with amazing costumes, fabulous lighting, on a very large stage. So there's a distance. It's not right in front of their face. And I think children will always, always take away from my productions things that really work for them and their imagination.
I was going to ask you, have you had trouble before with people saying this is too dark for kids?
Not really trouble. I think one is people, again, adults are always so cautious. And again, talk about morality. They're always trying to think we have to protect children from various things. The world of dance, as my world of dance, you don't need to protect children. You need to let children be able to make that that have the access to it and experience in a certain way. And remember, the Milwaukee Ballet has a very large school, which is here in the building that we work in. And the kids see it all the time. They see it through the window in the studio. They come and sit in the studio. The children are a part of it. There are children in the production. So I think it's Snow White. For children, it will tell the story of Snow White. And I think with the backstory of the falling star, and now we know what Claudia, the stepmother, is trying to achieve here, I think people will feel, oh, I understand a little bit more about Snow White. And it ends happily. There's a happy ending.
I find that the whole idea of beauty and that whole, the fairy tale, of course, deals with that. But I love the idea of exploring that in a non, maybe stereotypical way, where, as you say, ugliness is represented specifically, directly, you know, that we can be beautiful and ugly at the same time.
Absolutely. And I think that's ultimately very powerful, because how many times have we, on face value, have we made a judgment? And of course, with the way that we are subjected to the representation of what is beauty in the female form, with the commercial world we live in, and when we see posters that have been airbrushed and digitized or whatever it is, you know, photoshopped, it's fighting that image, that the first image of a beautiful person is something that everybody either wants to be or wants to have. And it's only once you get to delve deeper and know that person that the true color is revealed. And I think what's beautiful about this production is that I think there will be people in the audience who will probably not want to accept the fact that she's evil. She's just slightly misguided, or there's, you know, we'll try and justify, because the fact is she is so beautiful. So do we want to destroy beauty? No, we don't. But on the other hand, beauty can be very difficult. It's like some of the most exotic flowers. They are exotic, beautiful to look at, but probably not wise that you either smell them or eat them. You know, they could represent something more, the beauty of a rose that has the prickly thorn. So Sleeping Beauty, all of those allegories that I think represent beauty is dangerous. Beauty is dangerous. It's dangerous to have it, and it's dangerous to be subjected to it.
And it's also fleeting.
Totally fleeting, which is why the seasonal aspect of this is that a flower grows and it withers and dies, and it's that representation of the life cycle that I think is so important, and why I wanted it to be an apple orchard, because it feels that the apple, which is, as you rightfully said, is the Garden of Eden, it's temptation. And why would Snow White take an apple from a total stranger, because unless she felt that this was something that she had trust and comfort with, and the apple represents that. So we see her at the very beginning collecting apples with her father, and how familiar she is when she's in her secret garden with Gustav, who is her long, long time friend and will become the prince in inverted commas. An apple falls from the tree into her hand, and so it feeds the two of them. It feeds their love. It brings them together. She has the greatest trust in the apple. So when a beautiful woman in an exotic, wonderfully yellow coat arrives and said, here, little girl, you should have an apple, and it turns out to be the poison apple, it's quite believable that she would have taken it.
So what do you hope, once the production is here, are you hoping to take it out now?
Bonnie, I'm always, always, always hopeful that the productions that we create here in Milwaukee will have a life beyond here. And largely because I think I do create productions that are different from other ballet companies, and I do think that audiences respond well to them. They have the power to entice people to come to the ballet that otherwise wouldn't. They really do have the power to create a new audience. And my productions that have enjoyed performances in Washington and Colorado and Atlanta and other places all report good audience attendance, which is good. It reflects in the box office. So I'm hoping, again, that these productions, which are designed to move efficiently, they pack into one large lorry, which, you know, thinks, why is that important? That's important because it costs a lot of money to ship things around the country. So they're designed to be practical and help other companies to be able to stage them. As to getting people to come here and experience them in order to become interested and say, wow, I need to put that on my company, that's another story, because strangely enough, most ballet companies in this country tend to perform their various series around about the same time. So the amount of people I phone up and say, come to Milwaukee, come see the production, we'll look after you, we'll even give you beer and brats if that's what you want. No, I can't, because I'm performing that weekend, or we have something going on. So it's always very difficult. So we're relying on video representation to sell these products. Well, you and I know you miss a major part of anything when it's on video. You don't have that emotional response to being in the space and feeling the people around you, which again is why live theater is, you'll never replace live theater. It's that audience participation part of it that really helps enforce the way you feel about the work.
Michael Pink, as always, such a pleasure to talk to you, and best of luck with the new production.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Michael Pink is artistic director of the Milwaukee Ballet. The world premiere of Mirror, Mirror opens tomorrow night with music by Pink's longtime collaborator, composer Philip Feeney, some of which we're hearing now. It runs through Sunday at the Marcus Center's Eline Hall. He spoke with Bonnie North. What if Hamlet took place not just in the 16th century, but also billions of years in the future? Seriously, what if? A new movie seeks to answer that burning question, and we'll hear about it when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Shakespeare's Hamlet has been described in a lot of ways, words like classic and tragedy and masterpiece, not generally time-traveling epic or hilarious. That is, until now. Hamlet ADD is a reimagined film adaptation of Hamlet, still using Shakespeare's words, or many of them. It's the work of Milwaukee filmmakers Bobby Seraldo and Andrew Swant. Their film has already shown in Los Angeles and gets its Milwaukee premiere tomorrow evening at the Oriental Theater. Seraldo and Swant came to the project with high expectations. They were the recipients of a Mary Knoll Emerging Artists Fellowship 5 years ago and an Established Artists Fellowship last year. They tell Lake Effect's Bonnie North that the project began a full decade ago, but other things kept sidetracking them.
I don't think we've ever actually sat down with a calculator and really figured out accurately, but what would you say?
I'd say about half of the last 10 years we worked on it.
Off and on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then there were large breaks in the middle where we were doing other projects that were pretty big or took a lot of our time.
Well, this one is great because it takes Hamlet from the first time it would have been produced in the early 1600s to how far out? How far do you go?
Ooh, we go pretty far.
We go, well, if you talk to scientists about when the universe might potentially end due to a big crunch, say, I think that might be around 40 billion years in the future. Is that one estimate, Andrew?
Sounds good.
So about from it goes from 1600 AD to around 40 billion AD.
All in the course of the play.
Yeah.
It's a long play.
It is a long play. So I take it you're not doing a cut version. You're taking the full text.
It's pretty cut. We did really cut it down a lot. I think we ended up taking about at least half of the play out for time.
Yeah. Well, it's 5 hours, I think, otherwise.
Yeah.
Pretty much. Yep. If you do it the way it was written.
It's his longest play. And you know, we were always kind of shooting for something accessible. So I think, you know, iambic pentameter went out the window pretty early on because we had to cut so much. And we really, it's pretty true to the text, though. I always say, like, you could probably ace a test if you watched our movie instead of reading the play in high school or something.
Yeah, a lot has been thinned out, I would say, as opposed to large chunks being removed. It's more like we've sort of thinned it down just for the sake of speeding it up. And what we're going to show Thursday is going to be like a feature-length version, hour and a half, hour 40 minutes. But we will have a much longer version also.
The director's cut, kind of.
Yeah. The more we took out,
other things had to fill in.
Yeah.
So talk about some of that other stuff. The trailer is wonderful. The trailer alone makes me want to see the film just because of some of the guests that you have acting in this. You have some really wonderful people.
Yeah, we have Dustin Diamond, who plays Screech in Saved by the Bell. He plays one of the guards named Bernardo. Samwell from the What in the Butt video plays a communications officer on a spaceship. And there's a lot of, how would you describe our celebrity cameos?
Unique.
They have like a
niche.
Each has like a cult following. None of them are sort of huge celebrities on their own, but they each have their own strong, passionate cult following, I would say.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, for example, the guys who play the robot voices on the Mystery Science Theater 3000 show. We are huge fans of that show, and it was really exciting to meet them and to work with them. But, you know, it's kind of hard to say that they're, like, huge celebrities also, but they are to us.
Yeah, and I think to a lot of people who watch that, I mean, I'm still sad that it's gone. Now, Hamlet ADD, is that – what is the ADD?
I mean, it's kind of – there's time travel involved in the movie, so we were kind of pointing to AD in a way. But it's also – Hamlet is really distracted in our movie and can't seem to, you know, take care of the task at hand and keeps getting – sidetracked, and that's, I think, more what it's about. He takes the entire movie, you know, it takes him that long to decide if he's going to take any action or not.
Well, you know, there are people who would say that that's true in the play, too.
Yeah, definitely.
You really haven't changed anything, except maybe move it 4 billion years in the future.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, this project taking us 10 years is also kind of ironic, given how the plot works.
And so, Bobby, you get to play Hamlet. Do you play him in all iterations?
Yes.
Throughout time?
Yep. I play him from 1600 on. And Andrew plays his best friend, Horatio.
How do they change? How did these characters change from 1600 throughout time? The relationship stays the same.
Actually, we tried to prevent the characters from changing due to time passage. It's more like their costumes and the environments they live in and the vehicles they travel around in and the technology they use for communicating. You know, sometimes it's the radio that people listen to, and then the television is invented and they watch stuff on TV. But we didn't alter their personalities too much from the original play. We kind of wanted the original story of the play to stay constant throughout all these ages, because in a way it sort of speaks to how this play will kind of persist throughout the ages.
And has so far.
Yeah.
A lot of this was done in front of green screen, or was all of it done?
The whole film.
Whole film done in green screen. Mm-hmm. So what kind of challenges did that present to you as filmmakers?
Quite a few.
Yeah, big ones.
Initially, we kind of decided to do this. This is our first project, big project together. Shortly after we met, we decided we should do something feature length. So we thought doing something in front of the green screen would be easy in a way, because we wouldn't have to build any sets, and we would have a lot of control over the environment, and we could kind of do it ourselves without a big crew. And then it ended up being a whole lot more work
than you thought.
Yeah.
And so, Bobby, you're also chief animator, right?
Yeah.
So you must have been incredibly busy in addition to all the acting.
I still am.
Yeah. So
we started out thinking that this would be a time and money saver, but in the end, it really is a ton of work. And also, when you shoot on green screen, it's kind of funny. If you give yourself unlimited time, you'll just keep working on it. You know, you'll just keep working on it, making it better and better and better. Whereas if we hadn't shot with a green screen, once you shoot something that day, it's pretty much done. You've shot it. You're not going to go build that set over again. So it was a big learning experience.
You've screened it in LA and now you're screening it here. Is it essentially done?
It's very close. We screened one version in LA and we're screening a slightly different version Thursday night at the Oriental. And then we're going to have a slightly different version in the fall. And we'd ultimately like to cut up our 3-hour version into a webisode series, probably for YouTube, where I think we'd have about 50 3-minute episodes. And that sounds good. That's the plan right now, but we have to see what happens with all of this.
Now, are you hoping to get this picked up and taken out on a more robust tour schedule?
Sure. Yeah, that would be great. We want to take it on tour either way, though. Mm-hmm. Trying to find venues and cities and travel there with the film and show it and talk to people. We've always been really excited about traveling around with it a little bit.
What has been the reaction so far? I know it hasn't been shown that much yet, but
the reaction in Los Angeles was great. People were laughing really hard throughout the whole thing. So
yeah,
we were pretty happy, because that was the main reason we had made the movie in the first place, was we wanted to make people laugh. But really, no one's seen the film up until that screening. So we just had our fingers crossed that it was actually funny.
To someone other than you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, people are thinking Hamlet and laughing. Not usually
right,
what
right.
you think about.
It's not usually a comedy.
We tried to make that come across with the title a little bit. We're hoping people are clued in a little bit with the title, Hamlet, ADD. You kind of right away realize, okay, Hamlet, that doesn't sound maybe as exciting as a regular movie I might go see. But then the ADD on there, you think, well, maybe.
That sounds wacky.
Maybe they can handle this. Figured it out. They've cracked the code or something.
Maybe I'll have the patience to watch this.
So I have to ask, you know, I mean, it's not like it's any secret for anyone who knows Hamlet. I mean, in the play, kind of everybody dies.
Bonnie.
No spoilers.
Oh.
No, just kidding. Yeah, everyone dies at the end of Hamlet.
Yeah. What about Hamlet ADD?
Actually, that's a good question. Even we don't really know.
Mm-hmm.
But let's just put it this way. Everyone is killed.
Okay.
There is kind of some mysteries at the end.
Yeah. Very cool.
We tried to pepper a little bit of mystery throughout and put our own quirky storylines in here and there for people who are already familiar with the play.
And hopefully in an attempt to make it worth watching a second or third time too. Because, you know, by the end, you'd be like, oh, okay, so that's what they were doing at the beginning. Now I want to go back and check that out again.
Right. I mean, and I always love that when you see a film and you think, okay, wait, now I want to get back and see if I get the other jokes.
Mm-hmm.
So very quickly, once you're going to take this out, are you working on anything else? Or are all of your attentions and energies pretty much focused on this right now?
We're pretty focused on this right now. It's the final push, and we're just trying to get everything polished up and perfected. We do have a lot of plans for future projects, but we'll have to see exactly how they'll unfold or which one we'll do next.
And sticking to Milwaukee, staying here?
Yeah.
Yeah, we were the recipients of the Mary Knoll Fellowship this last year. And part of that was, you know, you're supposed to stay in town for an extra year. So we're like, well, we better stay.
Guess you better.
Yeah.
Guess you better.
And we've been here for a while, too.
Yeah. Now we love it here.
Well, it has been such a pleasure having you both in the studio. And best of luck with the screening on Thursday. And stay in touch. Let us know what you're doing next.
Thank you.
Definitely.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having us on.
Milwaukee filmmakers Bobby Seraldo and Andrew Swant's new movie, Hamlet ADD, makes its Milwaukee premiere tomorrow evening at the Landmark Oriental Theater. They spoke with Bonnie North. That's Wednesday's edition of Lake Effect. Hope you can join us tomorrow for the latest installment in our Real Talk with David Pate series. Plus, an Oklahoma native has an outsider's view of some really interesting Milwaukee landmarks. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for joining us today. I sure hope you'll tune in tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next on WUWM, and here and now comes your way at noon. We'll